session number 10763, Reel 7.
And LM decided that there should be started a unit called the Fighter Leaders School, and this was started at Chedworth in Gloucestershire, near Cicister, sire and sister. And the idea was that it would be used, it would be staffed by people who had had operational experience in the various theatres and leading experience as squadron commanders and flight commanders and wing leaders and that. And we should be training successors, and at the same time it would be a place where people who'd been off flying, who'd been leading, say, a couple of years ago or a year ago, and who'd been off flying on staff jobs and that kind of thing, could go to have a refresher. And we started this in January 1943, and I can always remember it was commanded by Paddy Woodhouse, a wing commander who'd taken on the Tangmere wing after Douglas Bader was shot down, and he was the CO of it, and there were two squadron leaders. I was one, and Bernard Ingham was another. And I can always remember seeing the first list of pupils, that's what they were called, who were coming. And I saw, to my astonishment, the name Brian Kinkham. And Brian has got an indoor decorating business just around the corner from here. He's very successful. And he's been a friend of mine. Well, this chap, he'd been leading the Kenley Wing. He'd been in through the Battle of Britain. He'd got a DSO and probably a bar and a DFC and this, and he'd been leading the Kenley Wing and so on. And here he was, and I said to Paddy Woodhouse, look, for God's sake, here's Brian. He's Cranwell trained, for one thing, and he's been leading all these wings and squadrons. He's been through the B&B, and what am I going to be telling this fellow about leading? I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. Well, he said, I mean, he's been off for some time now doing something other. He wants to be freshened up. I said, well, I mean, all respect, sir. I mean, I really don't feel like freshening this chap up. What, he said, you want to use your head, you know. And so, you know, I always remember O'Brien because, you know, he was a first-class officer. He was always playing the fool. He was always sort of lying up in the Savoy with some girl or other. I mean, you never see the way he went. I can remember it when he turned up, and I thought to myself, he had it in his hands because things were very difficult there. Chedworth was a new airfield. We lived in a lovely old Cotswold house, grey stone, lovely old manor house. But the airfield with those Nissen huts was appalling. There was mud all over the place, and if you got the Spitfires off the dispersal points and ran them off the runway or anything, I mean, you have a terrible time getting them out. And I thought to myself, well, if Brian Kinkham starts chucking his weight about here, this will be a disaster, this thing, because he can make us look like a lot of Charlies. But I'll never forget it. He might have been quite a new pupil coming on the course, and he did everything that he was, all these operations that we did and so on, and he was absolutely marvellous. And I thought to myself, well, all I can say is you've been trained at Cranwell, and they haven't half put some stuffing into you, because really it's remarkable. And he gave the lead, and no one else played the fool. And in the end, I was only there for a very short time because it was starting it, but and then it moved to Charmy Down near Bath, very nice airfield, and that was a sort of fairly old established place, and or much older than Chedworth. And it was really very good. It served a remarkable purpose. We used, for instance, to do these sweeps, so-called sweeps, in quotes, end quotes, across the Bristol Channel to the south coast of Wales. And there would be some Blenheims or something simulating the bombers and going to bomb, I don't know, Milford Haven or something, and we'd do this. And people used to take it in turns to read, to lead, and there was a very good friend of mine. I called Desmond Scott, a New Zealander, who had a remarkable record. He became one of the very youngest group captains in the Air Force. He was RNZAF, and he led the Typhoon Wing, I think it was 136 Wing, at Falaise, Caen Falaise. He did that tremendous attack on von Kluge's army. And they killed all those, they knocked off all those tanks. I mean, the 7th Army, I think it was the German 7th Army. I may be wrong about that, but I think it was the 7th Army. And he was a remarkable chap. And at this stage, he was, I think he was a flight lieutenant just going to be a squadron leader. And I think he was going to be a squadron leader of 487 Squadron, the New Zealand Squadron. I'm not sure of that, but I think anyhow, he's going to become a squadron leader. And his job, one day was to lead one morning, and I can remember I told them all what was to be done. I think I was a sort of duty instructor or something that morning, and I said, Scotty, you just do the briefing now for the wing. I mean, we had 36 aeroplanes. I think there were sort of three squadrons, you know, simulating three squadrons a wing, and there was to be RT silence all the way from Charmy down right up to the target area, which was just what one always did if you were going across from sort of Beachy Head to Lille or Upville or wherever it was. And then he would give the various instructions when we got near the target. And it was a terribly bumpy morning. And the aeroplanes were sort of going up and down, you know, sometimes, and particularly when you got out over that Devonshire and Cornish Peninsula and you were crossing over onto the water across the Bristol Channel. It got terrifically bumpy for some reason or other, and the aeroplanes were going up and down like this. Well, you know, he'd got a marvellous sense of humour, this fellow, and we'd got this RT silence, and no one was saying a thing, and all the aeroplanes going up and down, a lot of cumulus cloud about, and then suddenly you heard this thing switched on, and this sort of very rough New Zealand accent saying, "Rough as a badger's arse." I'll never forget it. And he switched on, and I knew perfectly well who it was. But it was, I think, the fighter leader school. Duncan Smith took it on after Paddy Woodhouse, and then I left to go and command a squadron. And afterwards, 616, and I went back. That's when I went back onto my second tour. But I think it probably served quite a useful purpose. It was decried a bit, but subsequently it was turned into, right at the end of the war, it was turned in, Richard actually commanded it. It was turned into the Central Fighter Establishment, and it was located at Tangmere. And then I think it went to West Raynham after that in Norfolk. But when it was at Tangmere, it became a very much larger organisation altogether, and they were then trying to assimilate all the lessons which had been learnt in the Second World War. That was really all my rest occupations. And as I've said, I was just very lucky indeed to have got those jobs. I was very lucky all the way through the service, always having being in interesting places. I mean, being able to go to Canada on that Empire Air training scheme, being able to go to a squadron like 66 Squadron with a lot of these ex-Battle of Britain people and good squadron commanders and so on to begin with. And then very lucky again when I went to Malta to be under Stan Turner. We've had all that. And then these good rest jobs. And because I had all these contacts, I mean, the extraordinary thing is, of course, that because I had, well, whatever it was, 6 years in the service with these different jobs, and particularly because I had these rest jobs when we were on the air staff, when we were working with the Americans too and all the Commonwealth people, I'd got all these contacts all over the world, and it's enabled me to do these books, to tell you the truth, these collections. I've just done this last one, which is being published in October, and I've written to these different people, friends that I'd known or got to know, and the Germans I got to know afterwards, and written to them all over the world, and they've responded, simply because one was able, I suppose, to create the impression, well, one went through the whole thing like they did, one understood it all, and so one got this response, and I was just terribly lucky. Now, and you see, the whole way through, all my three operational tours, I never got a scratch. I never had a splinter of any kind or anything in me. I was just providentially lucky. I was hit in the aeroplane. I mean, the aeroplanes were hit, but and did some forced landings and things, but I was never damaged myself. I was really fantastically lucky.
Can we say something in detail about your second operational tour from April to December 1943, please?
Yes, well, from that fighter leader school, I went to 616 Squadron, which was the South Yorkshire Auxiliary Squadron, and it was then based at Ibsley in 10 Group in the Middle Wallop sector, Ibsley in Hampshire, near the River Test. And it was, and as a matter of fact, it's one of the things that I've often thought about, really. This was essentially an English squadron. There were one or two Commonwealth people in it, but it was really essentially English, very much the 66th Squadron had been, and my first squadron that I'd been to. Now, they had Spitfires, Spitfire 6s, with these long wingtips with unpressurized and pressure cabins, which were supposed to be high-flying aeroplanes. That's what they'd been designed for. But we spent most of our time doing shipping strikes down around the Channel Islands, you know. The Germans used to run these E-boats across and sink shipping in the Channel, and we used to go after first light in the mornings and chase after them around all those ports in the Cherbourg Peninsula and the Channel Islands. And I must say, it wasn't really a very sort of pleasant operational period, although, I mean, they were terribly nice people in the squadron, and the station was commanded by Arthur Donaldson, who was a cousin of my wife's. There were three Donaldsons. They were marvellous people. There was Jack Baldy, who commanded 262 Squadron in Norway and was sunk in the Glorious. There was Arthur, who was at Ibsley, and he was in Malta after me, and he was chasing some Junkers 88 one day and shooting away at it, and 109 came and shot him up the backside, and he got a bullet right up, knocked his throttle off, and knocked these two fingers off his left hand. And he said, "That's all right." He said, "Not the important ones." I can always remember dear old Arthur. And then there was his brother, Teddy Donaldson, who subsequently beat the world's airspeed record in a Meteor from Tangier. But it was ordinary, sort of straightforward stuff with 616. They were the easiest lot of people to command. Now, it's worthwhile digressing just for a moment and talking about the composition of these different squadrons. I was lucky in the sense that I commanded three squadrons. That's two Spitfire squadrons and a Mosquito squadron right at the end of my third tour, two group, Basil Embry's lot. And I had one wing. And the wing that I had was made up of two English squadrons, and I had for a time a Polish squadron in the wing, and I had for a time a free French squadron in the wing. But so far as squadrons were concerned, I mean, I think that the really by far the most exceptional squadron was 249 in Malta, because we were a complete Commonwealth mix. I was the squadron commander, and I had two English flight commanders, UK flight commanders. I've always been a great believer in the best school of all being the school of experience. I wouldn't ever put people in because they happened to have been at a public school or something, but it so happened that these two fellows who were my flight commanders in 249 were both ex sort of public school people, and I've always felt that they had something of an advantage, because at the age of, I know myself, I mean, at the age of 16 or 17, you know, you made head of a house or something, and you had responsibility of looking after people and making them do things that they didn't necessarily want to do when one was young. And you made mistakes doing that, and you learned from it. And I think that it was, there's no question in my mind, that it was an advantage. I mean, I don't think that I should have been, I'll be honest about it, I don't think that I should have been such a good squadron commander if I hadn't had that kind of upbringing. And I was just lucky, fortunate to be able to have it, and I've always been grateful for it. But in this 249, apart from myself and the two flight commanders, we had, relatively speaking, very few UK people in the squadron at all, and they were nearly all Canadians and New Zealanders and Australians and South Africans, two or three Rhodesians, and three Americans. And it was a marvellous mix. Now, it was without any question of doubt that the most difficult squadron to command, particularly to begin with. I mean, when I first took on the squadron, you know, I felt that these fellows were sort of thinking, oh, here's some limey, who's this fellow, you know, and that. And it took probably a week or 10 days for them to reckon that I wasn't the sort of guy that they wanted to knock off at dawn in the morning and get rid of him. And we got a sort of comradeship and cohesion, really, in it, which was exceptional, bearing in mind the differences in temperaments which were there. And you know, they didn't necessarily, these Commonwealth people, they didn't necessarily, Australians, for instance, didn't necessarily take particularly kindly to start with to the Americans. You know what the Australians are, they're pretty outspoken and say what they think. And if you get a lot of that, well, it rubs people up sometimes the wrong way. But somehow this, the English squadron that I had at the start of my second tour, 616, it was a marvellously correct. I never had to bother with it. I had a good adjutant, I had good flight commanders, and the fellows were all at that stage in the war, April 1943 that was. Most of them were fairly experienced and so on. I mean, it was really, literally, in the well-used phrase, a piece of cake. But this thing in Malta was quite a different thing altogether. They were, and one really did require to watch it all the time. But having got them together like that, and having got them getting on and working together, they were absolutely magnificent. And I have a feeling that this sort of intermingling of the Commonwealth and the Americans and the South Africans were in the Commonwealth then. It sort of sharpened up the Englishness of the squadron, and it became, I think, more potent, more aggressive, really. I mean, the English squadrons that I had, particularly the 616, and then the English squadrons in the wing that I commanded at Coleshill during my second tour, they were very correct. They were very easy to deal with. They very seldom sort of put a foot wrong. The NCOs were good and so on. They were easy, but there's no doubt that as a sort of fighting unit, this 249, which I think, in fact, actually became the top scoring squadron in the British Commonwealth and our forces in the war. It's, you can't ever get confirmation of that. When I was a Member of Parliament, I put a question down on the order paper to ask what the Minister of Defence or Under Secretary of State for Air, or Secretary of State for Air, what was the top scoring squadron in the Air Force, and it was a sort of an equivocal answer, but it did say the 249. Well, certainly it was the top scoring squadron in Malta, in the Malta battle, and I think it was probably gave the impression that it was pretty close to being the top scoring squadron of all in the British and Commonwealth Air Forces in the war. But it was an interesting thing to see this comparison. So when I started off my second tour with 616, really, I mean, and particularly I'd been at that fighter leader school and so on, and I knew how to deal with things, it was very easy. Well, then I'd been there for about 2.5 months, and in July 43, end of June, beginning of July 43, I got a posting to command a wing, which was promotion for me, in North Africa, the North African landings had taken place in the previous autumn, and Sicily was about, Husky was about to take place, and I got this posting. Well, it was a sort of mixed feeling. I thought, well, God bless us, I've been abroad, I've been in Malta all that time in the Mediterranean, and it's been pretty rough, and I've been in Canada, and I thought, well, I don't know, send me out there again, it's pretty rough. But anyway, there we are, I mean, it's promotion, and I'll do it. And I can remember having the leave, embarkation leave, and getting all these jabs in the arm and that. And I was at home, and about 2 days before we were due to fly out, I was going to fly out from Lynham, I got a signal from the Air Ministry cancelling the posting to North Africa, and substituting a posting to Coltishall to command the wing, Spitfire wing, in 12 Group. And I thought to myself, well, what a break, you know. I mean, marvellous. And so I thought that was marvellous. And I was to port there in 2 days' time, I think, or almost forthwith. And I was just sort of turning this thing over in my mind, and the telephone bell rang at home. And this was the station commander on the telephone, and Vere Harvey, who subsequently was in the House of Commons with me, our Commodore A.V. Harvey, who's now Lord Harvey of Prestbury. I used to sit next to him in the house, and I'd never met him before. He rang me up, and he said, look here, old cock, he said, the SASO of 12 Group, our Commodore Lee, is coming here at tea time tomorrow and would like you to be here. Can you be here in time? And I said, yes, sir, I can. So anyhow, I drove up there. And we had tea. I'd never seen this chap Lee before, and to tell you the truth, I never saw him again afterwards. He had, I can remember it quite well, he had World War I ribbons on under his wings, and he might have had a military cross, I think he did. And anyway, at the end of tea, everything was fine, and then he just, as we were breaking up, he called me, he said, Lucas, just a moment. And I wondered whatever it was, you know. I mean, we'd been sitting down at tea, having exchanges and that. And so he took me over to the side, and he said, sit down there. And I sat down in the chair, and he sat down in the next chair, and he said, now, you know why you've been sent here? And I said, well, sir, I'm in to command the wing. It's a very privilege to get the chance. I'll do my best. Oh, he said, I know all that. He said, yes, but don't you know what's been happening here? Well, I suddenly thought to myself, Christ, well, bloody mighty, I mean, what have I been sent for here, sent to here? I had no idea what had been going on or who'd been doing anything or anything, because it was just a moment's notice. We hadn't been working in 12 Group or anything with my 616. We'd been in 10 and 11 Group. And he said, oh, well, I'll tell you exactly what's happened. He said, our three wing commanders flying, he said, here, have all been shot down and killed. And he said, you've been sent here to stop the rot. We don't want any more of it. Do you understand that? And I said, well, sir, I mean, insofar as you've told me something that I didn't know before, I must tell you that I do fully understand it, and I certainly concur, and we don't want to have another. Well, he said, that's all I just wanted you to know, Lucas. Now, I have to say that that was the stupidest thing that I heard a senior officer say to a sort of responsible embryo squadron commander or wing leader that I heard in the war. I could hardly imagine it. Anyway, that was the truth of it. Rabagliati had been shot down on some shipping strike just before, I think. There'd been Pete Blatchford, who'd been lost with that terrible operation when all those Venturas went to bomb some power station in Amsterdam, and they were all, a whole lot of them were shot down, bar one, which had turned back with engine failure, and Pete Blatchford was lost, and it was the most terrible cock-up. The thing went all wrong. And then there was, I can't remember who the chap was before, but anyway, they'd lost these three wing commanders flying, and so then I started off. Well, I very sort of quickly thought to myself, well, I don't know if this really has happened. I suppose they are all in bits and pieces, so I'd better have a talk to the squadron commanders to begin with. And so I said to them all that evening, I said, well, subject to any operational requirements, I want you all to come to my office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning in the control towers where the wing commander flying's office was, and we'll have a talk. Now, these fellows, all the three squadron commanders were, so far as the United Kingdom were concerned, all very experienced people, and they'd had good records in that, and they had, on the whole, it was 64 and 611 squadrons. They would both been in 11 Group and so on, and on the face of it, they seemed very good, but they'd had these reverses. Well, anyway, I said 9 o'clock in the office. Well, I went to bed, having got to know a lot of people I'd never met before there, station commander and admin people, the adjutant and all that. I'd got to talk to them the night before, and I went to bed. I was quite tired, and I left word with the batman to call me at 7:15 when I go down to the mess, have breakfast at 8 o'clock. And I was woken up I had an operations telephone, a scrambler, next door to me, and I could ring up the operations room and they'd ring me there. And at about soon after 7, I think, the bell went, and this was the operations one, and a voice the other end said, "It's the senior controller here, Wing Commander. I've got, my name is Squadron Leader David, and I've got bad news for you." And I was still asleep, and I just came to, and I thought, "Oh, Christ, whatever." I said, "Well, what is it?" And he said, "Well, there are 4 Spitfires which went out on an early morning reconnaissance to the Dutch coast to Den Helder at the request of the Navy. There were supposed to be 3 destroyers in Den Helder, and they wanted to have confirmation of this, and we sent a section of 4 out. And they haven't returned, and they must be considered overdue. We've been asked stations in East Anglia, and there's no reports of them at all. And they must be considered, anyway, missing." Well, do you know, when he said this to me, and I said, "Do you mean to say there were 3 destroyers in Den Helder and 4 Spitfires were sent to do this reconnaissance, and knowing how many 109s and 190s there are in Holland, because with all those American daylight raids starting up, they had moved a lot of stuff up into Holland." And he said, "Well, that's right." I said, "Who gave the instruction for 4 only to go?" Well, he said, "We got in touch with the squadron commander, who's missing, and he said, well, 4 Spitfire, I'll take 3 others with me, a section of 4 and I said, "Right." Well, about I thought to myself, here am I to stop the rot, we've lost 4 Spitfires, including a squadron commander. First morning I'm there, and I haven't even talked to the squadron commanders yet, and I thought, well, that's a fine way to start. And funnily enough, always through my life, everything that I've started, I've always had a difficulty to begin with. Doesn't matter whether it's in business or whether it's in journalism or whatever it was. The Air Force, whenever I took anything over, I ever became responsible for something, it was always, I can remember the first column I wrote for Beaverbrook as a sports columnist on the Sunday Express. I got a writ the first day. I'd never forget it. The libel. Anyway, I thought, this is just about my luck. And I got up, and then the batman brought the tea in, and within about 5 minutes the station commander was on the telephone, on the other telephone, and he said, "You heard what's happened?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I have." And he said, "Well, this is just what we're trying to stop." And I said, "Yes, sir, I obviously I'm responsible, I take, but no one told me a thing about it." And he said, "Well, maybe you should have left some instructions. They should have taken some. Should have told you what the operation was going to be, because you're in charge now." And I said, "Yes, and I fully accept that. But anyway, there we are." And well, he said, "Come and see me at 9 o'clock. So instead of having these squadron commanders in at 9 o'clock, I was being seen by the station commander. Well,